Hello, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from ABF, the Soldiers Charity. My guest for this edition of General Talk is Lord Dannett, who served as Chief of the General Staff from 2006 to 2009. Commissioned to the Green Howards, he has had a remarkable career. Awarded a military cross during the early days of the Northern Ireland Troubles, he suffered a major stroke when action of his battalion in 1977. We should have seen him imlead out of the armed forces. Yet, against all odds, he persevered and overcame the setback, rising to high command. Now a crossbencher in the House of Lords, with a reputation for saying how it is, he's a thorn in the side of government, over force levels and Britain's place in the world order. He's also a tireless campaigner for veteran welfare. Of his retirement from the army in 2009, he says you continue to feel a responsibility towards those you had the privilege of commanding, and a responsibility for their ongoing care and welfare. In a full, frank and wide-ranging interview, we began by discussing Lord Dannett's new book, Victory into Defeat, and the parallels with the modern army today, which are frankly alarming. I hope you enjoy the programme.
And thank you so much for coming on to General Talk, for being my guest for this month. You mentioned your new book, Victory to Defeat, the British Army, 1918 to 1940, which is published on the 14th of September by Osprey, part of Bloomsbury. Can you tell us a bit about the synopsis of the book and what it's all about?
Well, Harry, thank you. Victory to Defeat, British Army 1918 to 1940, is really trying to get at the conundrum as to why the British Army, with allies, defeated the Germans pretty soundly in November 1918, yet less than 22 years later, the same Germans beat the British Army pretty soundly in May, June, 1940. And this book really is an attempt to try and explain how that came about. Well, not surprisingly, there isn't a single answer. It's a multiple strand of answers. But I think from a narrowly military point of view, the desire that there should be, that the First World War should be the war to end wars, was so strong, both within the army. And a lot of regular soldiers who were not demobilized wanted to get back to soldiering as it was. And soldiering as it was pretty much policing the empire. From the government's point of view, the 10-year rule was passed, that there would be no commitment of the British Army in a major conflict for 10 years. And that kept rolling forward and forward. So, allied to that was a huge reduction in the amount of money being spent on the armed forces and on the army in particular, not surprisingly, and a huge reduction in the size of the army. But the interesting thing from a military point of view is that it was completely overlooked how we'd come to beat the Germans in the 100 Days campaign of 1918. We had managed to integrate the use of armor with air power, with infantry, with artillery, much more sophisticated use of artillery, much better battlefield communications. We had reintroduced maneuver to the battlefield, and we had effectively introduced what we would call mission command. Units were given much more flexibility in how they went forward. Now, the disappointing thing is that in the rush to demobilize and reduction of the army and get back to traditional forms of soldiering, what we had learned painfully in 1916, 17 and 18, we completely overlooked. But interestingly, it was not overlooked by the Germans. They studied what we had done to them in the 100 Days campaign. And during the 20s and 30s, particularly after Hitler came to power in 1933, when they effectively dumped themselves out of the Versailles Agreement and began to rearm and expand the Reichswehr. They experimented significantly with armor and produced themselves the capability that was unleashed on the world in September 1939 with their blitzkrieg attack on Poland. But while the Germans were building up this capability, we did not do the same. We had some very light experiments in the late 20s and early 30s with the experimental armor force, but it was never really taken forward. The main change that occurred in the British Army was not to go down the armored route, but to go down the mechanized route. Mm-hmm. So when war came in 1939, and we mobilized a second British Expeditionary Force, it was an army that went to France, mostly a small number of regular troops, but mostly territorial divisions are rapidly mobilized. But whereas the Germans attacked with armor, we deployed in lorries. So we were a mechanized army and they were an armored army. That's the narrow explanation. The wider explanation is that there were many distractions to the British government during this period. And we'd picked up many international obligations after the end of the First World War, not the least of which was administering the mandate for Palestine, the Ottoman Empire having collapsed, and we having played quite a major part in the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. We became responsible for Palestine, dealing with the Jews and with the Arabs. We had many imperial and colonial possessions around the world, which required a large number of troops to police. And the other thing that was interesting as far as the army was concerned is that we talk about the Cardwell system, where regiments had two battalions, one battalion overseas on duty in the empire, the other battalion at home recruiting and training. But this actually meant that when there was any question of forming an expeditionary force, these had to come from battalions that were at home, whose main function was recruiting and training to supply reinforcements for the empire. So putting any size of expeditionary force together meant effectively breaking the Cardwell system. And there was great reluctance to do that. Throw on top of policing the empire was the Irish question, which in after the end of the First World War, through 1920, 21, 22, until the Irish Free State became an independent country, this was a huge distraction for the British Army itself. You then throw in other sort of macroeconomic points, like the Great Depression, the general strike, the Wall Street crash, and money was very, very scarce. So you put all those points together and you find that with the rise of Germany, a determination under Chamberlain as Prime Minister that there should not be another European war, it became much easier to follow the policy of appeasement, trying to buy off Hitler than to rearm and face the inevitable. And it was very late in the day that we realized that appeasement was not going to work and that we had to consider rearming. The priority, even then, was not on the army. The priority was on the Air Force. And initially the priority on the Air Force was on building up a big bomber force, because the feeling and the fear in the 30s was that the bomber would always get through. There'd be devastation of our cities, and particularly gas would be deployed by bombs. And that was a real fear. Very late in the day, it was realized that actually the money being spent on bombers probably more effectively should be spent on fighters. Unfortunately, procurement switched away from bombers to a degree towards fighters just in the nick of time to give us sufficient Spitfires and Hurricanes to successfully conduct the Battle of Britain. So put all those points together, you come up with a fairly complex explanation as to the fact that we were victorious in November 1918 and humiliated in May, June 1940.
At the end of your the publicity sheet for the book, the final comment is a salutary warning for modern Britain. I mean, what you say here almost mirrors the situation we're in now. We've lost the ability for the British Army to conduct proper manoeuvre warfare that you and I used to know when we were in British Army of the Rhine. There aren't the distractions around, but there aren't the commitments either. And the army's now cut to the bone. What do we need to do to restore the confidence of our allies and the morale of our troops that the British Army is not a tier three bit player playing a minor role on the international stage, as Sacher recently commented?
Well, Harry, you're absolutely right to draw the parallels, which indeed we do in the book, between the 1930s and the situation now. The situation, as we well know, in the 1930s was that there was the rise of a dictator who was a considerable threat. Now, that threat eventually materialized into what became the Second World War. Where we are today is that there is a new dictator in Europe who is not just a threat, but he has already indulged in an illegal and ferocious war by Russia's attack on Ukraine. But the extraordinary thing is, although we very late in the day, in the 1930s, began the process of rearming, we are not doing that at the present moment. In fact, as far as UK military capability is concerned, and particularly of that of our land forces, we have quite properly and quite correctly gifted much of our equipment and much of our ammunition stockpiles to Ukraine so that they can fight and prosecute their war successfully. I mean, for example, 1st Regiment Royal Horse Artillery, one of the close support regiments in the 3rd Division, has no guns. All the AS-90 guns have been gifted to the Ukrainians. And we're woefully behind in replenishing our stockpiles of whether it's the NLAW anti-tank missiles, or whether it's 155 artillery ammunition, or indeed small arms ammunition. We're very woeful as far as that is concerned. And the disappointing thing is that although the Ministry of Defence and Ben Wallace, the Secretary of State, would say that he has argued till he's blue in the face with the Treasury that we should be seeing our defence expenditure up from 2% of GDP to somewhere near 2.5% of GDP, and there is more money in the programme, albeit later in the decade, the majority of that money is going into new technologies, it's going into maritime programmes, it's going into air programmes, and very little of it in the early years certainly is going into our land forces projects. And of course, the uncomfortable realisation that Chancellors of the Exchequer and Finance Ministers in Europe have to accept is that, yes, of course, it's important to resource the new ways of warfare, the modern technology, the high tech. But that doesn't mean to say that the old ways of warfare have gone out of the window. So to go back to that much overused analogy of the golf bag, just because you've got a snazzy new driver, which is absolutely at cutting edge of top technology, it doesn't mean to say that you can throw out the old trusted three wood that you really needed. And this, again, is borne out by what's happening in Ukraine. Yes, high technology is a really key part of that war, whether it's drones, whether it's satellite imagery, better communications, all that's really important. But there is still old-fashioned chin-to-chin slugging it out between infantrymen and armored soldiers. Yeah. So the modern way of warfare is going to be a combination of the new ways of warfare and the old ways of warfare.
At the end of the day, it is about man closing on man, and it is boots that will hold the ground. There is no other way of doing it. And you can have all the technology you want in the world, but that'll assist you. But it won't change the base nature, the visceral nature of warfare, which is hand-to-hand combat.
I mean, that's why my second book was called Boots on the Ground, Britain and Her Army Since 1945, which was a history of our country as seen through the eyes of the army, on the basis that we have been on stage for pretty much every act of the play from 1945 to the present time. And again, as much as high tech is really important, at the end of the day, it's soldiers on the ground, it's boots on the ground, that have to close with the enemy, whether it's in conventional war fighting or in counterinsurgency.
We are the only European country, I think, at the moment, who has not done some form of rearming. How do you think we hold our heads high and look our allies in the eye and say we're doing a good job as a result of that?
I think with great difficulty. And I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, the Germans Well, let's just wait and see what the Germans actually do. I mean, they're talking a good talk at the present moment about significantly increasing their defence expenditure. The Poles are most definitely increasing their defence expenditure. I think we will see the Polish army being the largest and probably the most capable army in Europe. Yes, we are accused of hiding behind our allies, and to an extent, I think we are actually doing that at the present moment, particularly as far as our land forces are concerned.
You're crossbench in the House of Lords, so you can look both ways. What is your opinion of Labour, of John Healey, and like Dan Jarvis, when if they come in, they've said they will reverse the 73,000 cut back to 82,000. It's not a huge fillip, but it's a move in the right direction. What's your view of that?
Well, I've talked these things through with John Healey and with Vernon Coker, who is the defence spokesman in the House of Lords, and they are very positive about the need to increase our defence spending. Of course, one has to temper that with it's easy to make these bold statements when you're in opposition. It's quite something else when you've got the books in front of you and you can see just what there is and what there isn't in the Treasury. And rather like when Gordon Brown's government left power in 2010 and David Cameron's government started, there was the note on the Chief Secretary's desk saying there is no money. And I think that an incoming government will find that actually the nation's finances are very, very stretched with many demands. But you then have to go back right to basics and say, well, what is the first duty of government? Is to provide properly for the security of the nation and the security of its citizens. So I think John Healey and Vernon Coker, Dan Jarvis and others are going to have to look very, very closely at this issue.
One of the areas that we've seen success, the British Army seen success in the last century, was Northern Ireland. What is your view of the Northern Ireland amnesty, whereby terrorists and soldiers are basically put on a par and given a blanket pardon when they've committed crimes?
Well, this is a very tricky issue, which is still to complete its passage through the Houses of Parliament. The House of Lords recently passed quite a large number of amendments, which have gone back to the Commons, and they will eventually be returned to the House of Lords again, finally. It's fair to say, it's accurate to say, that all political parties in Northern Ireland do not like the legislation that's going through. The only group, in my view, that benefits from this are veteran soldiers, because this will reduce the likelihood of speculative investigations and investigators coming to knock on old soldiers' doors. I had a debate in my name in 2018 in the House of Lords trying to bring pressure on this issue. And Boris Johnson eventually promised that there would be a bill, and we have got this bill. It's not a good bill. Everybody hates it. But I've discussed it through with Johnny Mercer, Minister of State for Veterans Affairs, and he is quite clear, and I agree with him, that there will not be another bill. This is the only bill we're going to get. But it does offer a measure of protection to soldiers from unwarranted phishing investigations, which was the hallmark of what's been going on for quite some time. And the reason why it's an unfair playing field, an unlevel playing field, is that, as you know as well as I do, in the British Army, we kept very close records of patrols and who was where doing what on any particular day at any particular time. Did the IRA? No. Did the UVF or UDA? No. So when an investigator wants to start to look into an incident, where is the first place to start? It's to the Army's records. And therefore knock on the door to a veteran soldier to start asking him questions. Now, that soldier may well be in his late 60s, early 70s now. It's a very worrying experience when that happens. It's a fearful experience. And frankly, it's not right and it's not fair. So now that all legal proceedings are being suspended, then it removes the likelihood of that knock on the door for old soldiers.
You won a military cross in Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland was a success story. What was the difference between Iraq and Afghanistan that it wasn't a success story?
Well, Northern Ireland was a success story over a period of 38 years. So successive governments had to exercise strategic patience to be prepared to run the operation from 1969 to 2007. That's an extraordinary length of time, far longer than Iraq or Afghanistan. I think Well, it's, you start to unpick it. We were quite right in late 2001, early 2002, to go into Afghanistan in support of the Americans, who threw out Al-Qaeda who were hosting the Taliban. That was the right thing to do. The absolutely right thing to do would have been then to continue supporting the new government in Afghanistan and building that country up. The strategic error of biblical proportions was the decision that George W. Bush took to finish off his father's business by going into Iraq ultimately in early 2003. And that diverted the West's attention from what it could be doing well in Afghanistan to what it started to do really badly in Iraq. Yes, okay, we defeated Saddam Hussein's army. Well, we'd done that in 1990, 1991, and they'd never recovered. So we finished them off in 2003. And there was this naive neocon thought that having swept away the Saddam Hussein regime, we could put other more moderate hands on the levers of government in Baghdad and change the direction of the country and make it some kind of exemplar of a democratic liberal country in the Middle East. Well, that was never going to happen. And when it was quite clear that was never going to happen, there was no plan B. And then various terrible mistakes were made, like disbanding the Ba'ath Party and disbanding the Iraqi army, which immediately put large numbers of armed troops disaffected on the streets, as it were. And into that vacuum, that was an opportunity for Al-Qaeda to fill that vacuum. And the situation, as we know, deteriorated right across Iraq until late in the day, the Americans realized that they were in danger of losing. And then we had the very large surge, and they threw numbers at the problem and to an extent managed to stabilize the problem. But while all that was going on, we, the British, offered to lead the new NATO operation in southern Afghanistan starting in summer 2006. And from our point of view, that was a real burden. I was commander-in-chief in 2005-2006, and the Ministry of Defence planning assumption was that by the middle of 2006, we would be down to between 1,000 and 1,500 soldiers in Iraq as we ramped up in Afghanistan. Well, the fact of the matter was, come the middle of 2006, we had a better part of 10,000 in Iraq still, yet we still went ahead with the new operation in southern Afghanistan, which itself quickly ramped up to 10,000. Well, that over a length of time was unsustainable. So we fell into the classic trap of having a split aim of trying to do what we could in Iraq, but then trying to do what we could in Afghanistan, which was why I was one of those that encouraged the government to get out of Iraq sometime soon so that we could focus on what was probably more important and achievable, which was having success in Afghanistan.
But the reality was also that the Americans took their own more decisive action, was that they relieved us of command in Basra.
Yes. Well, this was during Operation Charge of the Knights, when, yes, we didn't cover ourselves in glory at that stage, and the Americans very much had to come to our assistance. But if I say when you're fighting with allies and you're working with partners, sometimes a partner needs to come to the assistance of another partner. And that was what happened. I think if I'm being overly critical, I think the British effort in Basra and in southern Afghanistan was allowed by the Americans to become too solo. We were able to go our own way for too long. I think while they were surging, we were reducing. Now, whether that was the right thing to do or not, I think can become quite a major debating point. But my underlying point is that we were not capable of indefinitely going on at the level of 10,000 in Iraq and 10,000 in Afghanistan. And we were choosing to prioritize Afghanistan over Iraq.
You have led a remarkable life. You won, as I said, a military cross in Northern Ireland. You've risen to high rank against the odds, really, after suffering a major stroke in 1977 at the age of 26, where, for all intents and purposes, your career was over and you were looking for a job outside. I know you have a strong faith, but what was it that drove you on to overcome this major setback?
Well, as you say, it was really quite a surprise on the 11th of November 1977 to suddenly find that, as the adjutant of the battalion about to preside over our Armistice Day service, I suddenly wasn't there, and they found me unconscious and paralysed on the floor of battalion headquarters once the service was over. And as the German doctor in the big teaching hospital in Berlin said to Piff, my wife of only 6 months, when she asked what my chances were, he said, "Well, 'tis how you say in England, 50-50, we win some, we lose some." So things weren't actually brilliant at that particular moment. But the extraordinary thing was that we're always so busy in life that you rush from thing to thing. But when you're paralyzed and stuck in a bed, it gives you an enforced opportunity just to reflect on life and reflect on how things are and how they were and how they should be. And it was during that period of reflection that, as you say, Christian faith has always been important to me, but I rather reflected on whether I'd taken my Christian faith seriously or not, or just paid lip service to it. And I came to the conclusion that, well, if one was going to try and live by the standards of the Christian faith, then it was something to be done properly and wholeheartedly and thoroughly, as opposed to compromise here, compromise there, do whatever was convenient. So that was really quite a major reflection and conclusion that I came to. Fortunately, from a medical point of view, it did take 2 years in total before I was fully fit again. Having said that, I was back at work, I think 4 or 5 months after the stroke occurred, but I wasn't fully fit for 2 years, but I had a very understanding commanding officer. And then my next job after being adjutant, I went on the staff at Sandhurst, where interestingly, Rupert Smith was recovering from having been blown up in Crossman Glen. He was the chief instructor of Old College, and I was an assistant instructor in Old College, and we both recuperated together. So really, at the end of that 2 year period, I was fit and healthy and well again. The medical board said, "Well, look, you've been very ill. You seem to have made a complete recovery. Put it behind you and crack on." Well, that's fine. It's easier said than done. I don't think a day ever goes past when I don't recall what happened. And there are certain legacy things. I wear my shoes out unevenly. I used to be able to bowl quite well at cricket. I can't bowl. I used to play the guitar. I can't play the guitar. There's just sort of a bit of a weakness on the right-hand side. But it didn't actually stop me from progressing up through the ranks and becoming head of the army. You don't need to play the guitar to be chief of the general staff.
You're an example as all in that sense of triumph over adversity. As I said, you're no stranger to hardship or disability in that sense. You devote a deal of your time and resource to veterans and veteran care. You were one of the founders of Help for Heroes in the early days. You're also co-chair of the Soldiering On Awards, hosted by Jeremy Vine on the 27th of September. This at a glittering black tie gala event at the Park Plaza Hotel on Westminster Bridge. It is a chance also for the public to show their appreciation for some of the things our veterans have achieved against all odds. And specifically, we talk about the Inspiration Award. What characteristics are you looking for in the winner of that category?
Well, it is, as you say, it's the Lifetime Achievement Award. This is determined by public vote, by a popular vote. Yeah. So it's down to individuals to look at those three candidates and decide who probably over an extended period of time, a lifetime, has made the major contribution. The whole basis of the Soldiering On Awards is to recognise those who have overcome adversity, particularly actually businesses as well, who have made themselves veteran friendly. And it's really a multiplicity of ways that individuals have overcome their adversity, and organizations and individuals, charities, businesses have supported our veteran community. And I think this is a really important thing, because we need to recognize those who are willing to put on uniform and willing to serve for king and country, and to thank them and recognize them for their service. So that's why the Soldiering on Awards is really important. And I think more widely, as someone who was Commander-in-Chief, the number two job in the Army, and then the number one job in the Army from 2005 to 2009, when we were going through some of the more difficult years of Iraq and Afghanistan together, it wasn't just a question on the 28th of August 2009, as I stood down as Chief of the General Staff to say, well, that's it, 40 years done and dusted, I'm off to go and farm in Norfolk. You actually continue to feel a responsibility towards those you've had the privilege of commanding and serving with, and to feel a responsibility for their ongoing care and welfare. And that's why I stayed pretty closely involved with a lot of the service charities, because it's an ongoing responsibility. One feels a responsibility towards those with whom one served.
You work tirelessly in the name of service issues and veterans and servicemen and women today. Does it irk you that it falls to of a certain number of senior officers to have to do that role?
Well, the service charity sector is pretty broad and wide. There are a lot of service charities, probably too many service charities, if we're honest. So there are a lot of people involved. Sometimes people say to me, shouldn't the government do more? Well, the answer is yes, the government should do more. But I also always say, actually, the British way has always been, when the public, private and charitable sectors come together, that's when we can achieve an awful lot. And if you look at the Royal Hospital Chelsea, that's a classic example of the private, public and charitable sector coming together all those centuries ago. And I think that's what we've seen with all our service charities, private individuals, the private sector put money in, the government does a certain amount, but when it comes together in a coordinated fashion, and I think that's doing the best for our veterans. But it does need leadership. It does need people who are capable of being leaders to keep pressing the envelope, to keep pushing out, leading the charities, pressing the government. It's got to be done.
You mentioned farming in Norfolk, and I know that we're talking to you on your farm in Norfolk at the moment, and I imagine that harvest is now well underway, or if not, it certainly should be. But talking of Norfolk, your wife Pippa, Lady Dannett, is Lord Lieutenant from Norfolk. Now you're only a Deputy Lieutenant, so what happens in the morning? Is there a sort of unseemly scrabble for the gold braid, or what happens? Do you have to salute her?
Well, it's an interesting question. I've been a Deputy Lieutenant in Norfolk for about 12 years, and she's been Lord Lieutenant for 4 years, yes. So when she was appointed Lord Lieutenant, she effectively became my boss. However, I'm also a Deputy Lieutenant in Greater London. So when we cross the M25, then I become the boss in a light-hearted sort of way. But we work together very, very well in Norfolk, and I think when she was appointed, a number of people said, actually, you're getting two for the price of one here. And we do a lot together. In fact, you know, in an RSS time, we're jumping in the car and going off to an event in North Norfolk this evening, which His Majesty the King is attending. So, she's the main man, but I'm there in support.
Great stuff. Richard Dannett, Lord Dannett, former Chief of the General Staff, thank you very much for appearing on General Talk this afternoon.
Thank you very much indeed. I very much enjoyed the experience.
And my thanks to General Lord Dannett. Victory into Defeat, the British Army 1918 to 1940, Lord Dannett's new book, co-authored with Robert Lyman, published by Osprey on the 14th of September, is available for pre-order online. Public voting for the Soldiering On Awards closes on the 6th of August. For further details and to cast your vote, please visit soldieringon.org. And if you enjoyed this podcast and would like to listen to other programmes in the archive, then please visit the podcast page at soldierscharity.org. And as you play out the quick march of the Green Howards, the Bonnie English Rose, from me, Harry Bucknell, here in Dorset, thank you for listening, and until next time, farewell. The Bonnie English Rose is played by the regimental band of the Green Howards. The series editors are Kath Mills and Neil Kernahan, with studio editing by Michael Ciliano. This has been a Gamekeeper production Prebjev, the Soldiers' Charity.